and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. It's the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn, and we are a week into June already. Wow. For those of you who are still getting over the fact that Memorial Day has come and gone, that includes me, by the way. Now we're a week into June. Wow. And finally, some June weather on tap. Not today, but we're going to start turning things around tomorrow, and weekend looks scary good, most folks would say. About time. Several guests joining us today. Our first guest will be visiting with us by telephone in just a few minutes. His name is Dan Blatt. We're going to be talking about the Great Depression. A little history lesson, a little economics lesson for us, which I think we need. You know, with all the news today about the economy, should we cancel the NAFTA free trade agreement? Do we need to put higher tariffs on imports? A lot of economic news. Maybe we can better understand it if we learn a little bit from economist Dan Blatt. He'll be visiting with us. Actually, we were scheduled to chat with Dan last month, but he had to cancel out at the last minute, so we're pleased to be able to reschedule him and talk to him today. He'll be joining us shortly. And then later on the program today, guests from the ARC of Butler County. The ARC of Butler County. I'll be talking about what they are up to. And they are the next year nonprofit spotlight agency of the month, by the way. And then also on the program today, Ginger Fenton will be joining us. Ginger is with Penn State Extension. She is the dairy education educator for Penn State Extension, talking about dairy issues. Dairy, I believe, is still pretty big here in Butler County. We'll have to check with Ginger about that. Agriculture remains the number two industry in Butler County, behind tourism, believe it or not. Now tourism number one. And I think dairy is a pretty big part, although we certainly don't have the number of dairy processing operations that we used to have in years gone by. We'll talk about that with Ginger Fenton a little bit later on the program today. But our first guest, Dan Blatt, will be lining him up here momentarily. I do want to tell you about some things that are coming up over the next few days. Tomorrow we'll be chatting with Pat Collins about a new World War II exhibit that's coming to Butler. Pat is the director of the Butler County Historical Society. We'll find out what that's all about. I think it's coming later this month. I'll get the details. Also tomorrow, Dr. Nick Neupower, president of Butler County Community College, stops in for a visit. Been a lot of news with regard to higher education in the past few weeks. And then on Friday, we will welcome once again for a nice sit-down chat. Bob Tattern will be with us on Friday. Bob is a well-known sports reporter, broadcaster in western Pennsylvania for many years, many decades, as a matter of fact. He's a veteran. He has a ton of stories, and they're fun, and they're interesting, and he's just a great guy to talk to be honest with you. Very pleasant conversationalist. And I believe he'll be bringing some more of his books to give away. We'll be playing trivia. Sports trivia on Friday, so we look forward to a lot of fun. Bob's been with us in the past, and it's been a blast. So all of that's still to come. And next week, we have a Vietnam veteran who's going to be chatting with us about... it's been a long time now since Vietnam, huh? Yeah. So lots of stuff to look forward to on the program. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll be hooking up with our first guest, Dan Blatt, talking about the Great Depression. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. And I'll be back right after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Going to be discussing, listeners, something that I'm sure you've all heard of, the Great Depression. Who hasn't heard of the Great Depression? But how much do you know about it? Well, that's a good question. And I might be first in line to want to know a little bit more about the Great Depression. We will find out about it today with our guest on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is Dan Blatt, and he is the author of a book entitled Understanding the Great Depression and the Failures of Modern Economic Policy. First of all, Dan Blatt, nice to meet you. Terrific to have you with us for a few minutes here on the program today.
Hi, Dave, and thanks for having me on the program.
Sure. Great Depression, everybody has heard about it. Most people could kind of peg it, at least roughly, to the late 1920s. I don't know how much further a lot of us could go, so we'll talk a little bit about that, and obviously about your book. A little bit about our guest, listeners, Dan Blatt, author of Understanding the Great Depression, has over 50 years of experience in finance, law, media, and the government. He's been the publisher and author of the Futurecasts online magazine for the past couple of decades. He was, prior to that, a financial columnist for a number of business newspapers. He was also a special advisor to the Congressional Statutory Studies Group, providing a comparative analysis of many procurement regulations. So with that preface, so you know a little bit about Dan, and know that he knows of what he speaks here today. Let's first talk about the Great Depression. What really caused it, Dan Blatt?
Well, it was not something that just came down from heaven. It was something that government policy had to work really hard to undermine our economic markets. And that goes all the way back, as most things in 20th century history, that goes right back to World War One and the Treaty of Versailles and the trade war that was started by the United States with the Fordney-McCumber tariff in 1922. Mm. So the difference between the Great Depression and the business cycle normally is that governments actively destroyed international markets. And when you destroy a market, it can't recover. So that's why we had a decade-long depression instead of having a business cycle recession that goes down and resolves its problems and then recovers.
Mm-hmm. I suppose if I'd have been on a quiz show, Dan, and somebody said what caused the Great Depression, I would have said the stock market crash of 1929. Would I have been wrong, Dan?
Yes, you would have been. It's a very common error. And for example, what most people don't realize is that by April of 1930, the stock market had rebounded and only had about a 12% loss at that time. Hmm. So if you think that the stock market crash caused the Great Depression, you have to explain why the rebound didn't prevent the Great Depression. No, that was just a phenomenon of the Depression, and it had some impact there is an infinite chain of cause and effect that, that goes on in economics, and that was a very large, dramatic link in that chain. But to understand it, you have to understand all the things, especially in government policies that set up the market for that boom and bust that occurred in 1929.
Well, I would have learned a lot already, because I would have said the stock market crash, which was, by the way, late in the year in 1929, was it not? It was around Halloween or somewhere.
It was on, yeah, it was in the last week of October, and 2 days, a Monday and Tuesday, you had tremendous drops, and the bottom wasn't hit until the middle of November. Interestingly, for today, during that time, the Federal Reserve, or the new Federal Reserve, was doing pretty much the same thing that it's doing today. It was keeping its interest rates below the market rates. In those days, the market rates were the call money market rates. It was keeping them below those rates for a long time, and it was sterilizing reserves, sterilizing the gold inflows so that they would not affect our money supply. And it was quite effective at that. Except that that type of a policy, as we've seen in Japan in the 80s and China a couple of decades ago, that combination usually results in a boom and bust response. And in 1929, both the boom and the bust were quite dramatic.
Well, let me give you another, again, if I were under the gun on a quiz show, and someone would say, "So, what did the federal government do in response to the stock market crash and the Great Depression?"
Proceeded to make things even worse by passing the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and all of our trading partners got real angry at us, and so they increased all their tariffs against us. By the time 1930 was over, they had destroyed 30% of the market for our great cash crops, wheat, corn, cotton, and so forth, and 20% of our automotive market was exports. In those days, surprise, surprise, Detroit actually made vehicles that people wanted, and we were exporting 20% of our produce, and that was cut in half very suddenly in the beginning of 1929. And that started the chain of events that led to the stock market crash.
We're talking, listeners, for those of you who may have joined us a few minutes late here on this segment of It's Your Turn on WISR. Let's find Dan Blatt is our guest. We're talking about his book, Understanding the Great Depression and the Failures of Modern Economic Policy. And I have to ask you, Dan, when you say one of the things that the government did wrong right after the stock market crash was imposing all of these tariffs on incoming goods from other countries. Does that at all come into play with the desires of current President Trump to withdraw from some of these trade agreements that we've made, NAFTA and the Pacific Rim trade agreement? Does that factor in at all?
Well, the trade agreements that he's not entering into are one thing, because we do have a globalized world already. But if he proceeds pretty far along the line of tariffs and other nations turn around and retaliate against us, that's the sort of thing that has to go on pretty far to get to the point where we were in the 1920s. But that's the road down which you go to get into a situation that provided us with a Great Depression. So it's not fun and games.
It's a tough call. I mean, here in our immediate area, we're just north of Pittsburgh, Dan, and we have a big steel plant here in our town. And for many years, there have been calls for additional protection for domestic steelmakers. And I understand that President Trump is considering this right now. You say maybe not such a good idea in the long haul. Is that what you're saying?
You know, if you have particular instances like that for political responses and so forth, you're giving benefits to particular constituencies that add to the course of the economy as a whole. It's not good, but as I say, that doesn't even come close to the broad generalized tariffs like the Fordney-McCumber tariff and the Smoot-Hawley tariff and the responses of our trading partners that destroyed international markets and kept them destroyed right through the 1930s.
Can you
No, this is serious business, and it mustn't go too far.
You mentioned earlier, and I'd like to expand on that just a little bit here. You mentioned some of the causes leading up to the stock market crash and then the Great Depression were policies that were put into place after World War One. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because that's an area of our history that a lot of us are not real familiar with, that period between World War One and the stock market crash.
Well, all 20th century history flows from World War One, and the Treaty of Versailles, of course, imposed burdens on Germany, reparations, and it Balkanized the Balkans. And those were the countries that fell into depression first in late 28, early 29. All of Central Europe and Germany fell into the depression first. And the Allies that won the war borrowed lots of money from us. These were dollar-denominated debts. Now the question arises, where are they going to get the dollars to service those debts? They have to sell to us in the U.S. market to earn the dollars. And in 1922, we decided to shut our market to them. So this destabilized the entire financial system of the United States and the European world. Wall Street stepped up to the plate and started lending money to Europe. For several years, they lent enough money to Europe so that the system continued on, but by 1928, Wall Street got tired of sending so much money to Europe, and that's when things started falling apart.
So what's interesting to me, and I want to talk about one more thing, and then we have to take a quick break, what has now become known as the Great Recession, which started back in 08, 09, and we found out later was not just affecting the United States. We had the bursting of the housing bubble, and then everything started to fall apart. This affected many other countries in the world, too, particularly throughout Europe. They had to enact some pretty severe economic policies. So the Great Depression back in the late 20s, 30s, that was worldwide as well. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was not just a U.S. phenomenon. It was worldwide. And our Great Recession, interestingly enough, the mortgage securities bubble had proceeded far enough by 2005 that even Congress started taking notice of it and was asking questions about it. But Greenspan and the other regulators didn't want to touch it anymore. And so it just proceeded to get worse and worse until it busted by itself in 07, 08. But, of course, that's what the business cycle is for. You know, we had this fellow Bernie Madoff also that the regulators were looking at but couldn't bestir themselves to do anything about. But it's the recession, it's the business cycle, when it turns down, that cleanses the system of things like the Bernie Madoff and the securities bubble, the mortgage securities bubble. And that's what an ordinary business cycle is for, although I must admit that the busting of the bubble was a pretty extreme example of of how that proceeds.
When we come back, listeners, we have to take a quick break here. We have a bit more time to chat with Dan Blatt, author of Understanding the Great Depression and Failures of Modern Economic Policy. This is a very very enlightening chatting with him. When we come back, we're going to talk about the New Deal, the response to the Great Depression, and some of the ramifications of economic policy then for today, for today's age. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. And we'll be back right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back, folks. Joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn. No problem. My name is Dave Malarkey here on WISR. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is Dan Blatt, and we're discussing his book. Dan is the author of a book entitled Understanding the Great Depression and Failures of Modern Economic Policy. A bit of a side note here, Dan, before we talk about some of the things I mentioned there before the break. I think that it's a generalization, but it's probably true that most Americans don't understand enough about economics and how it works. We don't understand as much as we should, right?
Well, one of the problems is that everybody with an ideological or political interest is busy propagandizing on economics, and they just spread a fog of misinformation around. And if you don't have any background, then you have no way to protect yourself from the contentions of the ideologues and political interests and so forth. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to give people enough information so that they could readily reject the catastrophists who come out of the woodwork every recession saying, you must do what I want you to do or we're going to have another, Great Depression. It's the phantom menace that people use. For example, in the last recession, they came out of the woodwork saying, well, we gotta save Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or we're going to have another Great Depression. And they succeeded that time in directing government policy into a whole bunch of lines where it might not otherwise have gone. So people have to understand that, yes, we're going to have a business cycle, but in a globalized world, you are not going to have another Great Depression. And whatever happens, the market has tremendous recuperative powers, tremendous resiliency, and we will come out of it without having to adopt all of these extreme measures.
One of the responses to the Great Depression was the New Deal. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected. See if I can remember my history. I think it was 1932 he was first elected. The New Deal was certainly one of the centerpieces of his vision. But you talk in your book, and I didn't realize this either. The New Deal, despite doubling many supply and massive amounts of budget deficit stimulus, it didn't actually end the Great Depression early on. I didn't realize that.
Well, in 1934, we had 20% unemployment. We had a bounce when they reopened the banks, but still had 20% unemployment. By 1938, we had 19% unemployment. So, boy, that's a big response to the extensive efforts of the New Deal, a 1% gain in unemployment. The New Deal had some real accomplishments in the regulatory sphere. The disclosure approach to securities laws at the local level, we started registering title to real estate so people could have confidence when they buy and sell homes. And in the banking system, they had some real advances in regulation. But what today we call industrial policy, where the government actually steps up and tries to run parts of the economy. In those days, it was the National Industrial Recovery Act, where they actually tried to cartelize the entire economy from the banking sector right down to the brooms. And that was a disaster that fortunately the Supreme Court overturned as beyond the powers of our federal government.
What about the Federal Reserve? That had come into being at about this time. Did they do any of the right things or the wrong things to try to get us out of the Great Depression?
Yeah, they, like you say, they were new and they were struggling, and they made a lot of mistakes, and it did make things worse by sterilizing the flow of gold, for example. Gold was the international reserve currency of the day. We started accumulating all the gold. We had about almost half the world's monetary gold at that time. And it was one of the reasons why England couldn't maintain its peg to the pound, its pound peg to gold. And it was the devaluation of the pound in 1931 that brought the Depression to a new low. The pound in those days was a big central currency in the world, like the dollar is today. So that was a big event in the course of the Great Depression. So the Federal Reserve didn't help. It didn't help, but you would have had a Great Depression anyway, even without the mistakes that it made.
Have we learned any lessons for today's economy, for today's society, about just what government can and cannot do in the face of a recession or a downturn?
Well, thank goodness, even government is capable of learning. And hopefully it doesn't always take a Great Depression to teach it. Right after World War II, we got busy reopening international markets. And we started going down the globalization world, the globalization road, which has has supported our prosperity and this prosperity around the world ever since. So we have avoided the trade wars. We do have a globalized world, but a lot of other things and a lot of other ways we haven't learned very much. For example, as I pointed out, there's a great similarities between the Federal Reserve's policies today, which is involves monetary expansion and the sterilizing of reserves. We have $2.6 trillion in reserves that are sterilized within the Federal Reserve right now. And that keeps price inflation, commodity price, consumer price inflation in check, but it does lead almost always to asset price inflation, which in its own way can be as bad as consumer price inflation. By definition, almost, if you have asset price inflation, you're creating bubbles, and that leads to problems.
There are some people today who decry globalization. I've heard people say on the street and in syndicated columns, it's time that America went back to taking care of ourselves, making our own stuff, not worrying about importing it from other countries. Is this a very short-sighted view, Dan Blatt?
Change always discomforts some people, but you can't stand in the way of change. Your proper response to change is to make sure that you have flexible markets and supporting rules and regulations that facilitate our capitalist markets so that people in the markets can prosper. There is no way to protect everybody from change.
Why is it that so many economists struggle to correctly forecast economic events? You mentioned Greenspan earlier, Alan Greenspan. He was revered as head of the Federal Reserve. In fact, incoming presidents wanted to keep him on board. They didn't want to change captains. And yet, he never talked about the housing bust and the Great Recession that came in 2008. How come so many economists and economic forecasts are wrong?
Well, I remember him answering questions to Congress in 05, and he gave a mealy-mouthed response, oh, who is to say that the markets are wrong, and so forth. And so it took another 2 years for the bubble to bust, and in the nature of these things, they always accelerate. I have seen calculations that 40% of the damage accrued in the 2 years for between 05 and 07. So that was damaging. But the reason why their forecast, they can't forecast. There's something called Keynesian economics that were first developed by John Maynard Keynes, and they are dominant in official and academic circles today. And Keynesian economists cannot forecast the failure of their own policies. Therefore, they always miss economic downturns. Now, I have no idea how you're supposed to conduct economic policy when you cannot professionally forecast when the economy is going to turn down. What can be more important than knowledge of when the economy is going to turn down? But just as a matter of ideology and belief in the Keynesian approach to economics, they can't forecast their own failure. And so right away, that inhibits them from being able to forecast anything. They give projections, mm-hmm. projections. And you should always ask an economist when he gives you projections, what's the next downturn going to do to your projections? Because they never include the downturn in those predictions.
So it's interesting stuff, folks, and important to learn about because we're better able to interpret the headlines of the day, the economic news of the day. We've been chatting with Dan Blatt, again, the author of his book, the author of a book entitled Understanding the Great Depression and Failures of Modern Economic Policy. One final question, Dan. Are you still publishing your online financial magazine, Futurecasts?
Yeah, I've slowed down. I no longer call it a magazine. I now call it a journal, and I publish articles on it when I get a book that interests me.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently, I did an article on a couple of books by Justice Breyer on his philosophy, his interpretive philosophy that he wants to develop through the Supreme Court. And things like that, I still do on occasion. I don't call it a magazine anymore because I don't publish it on a regular monthly basis.
Is it still at futurecasts.com?
It certainly is at futurecasts.com, and it does have an email button on it, and I do answer my email.
Thanks, Dan Blatt. Nice to meet you. Very educational to speak with you today. Thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Sure. So long now.
Bye-bye.
As the sun rose on a warm spring morning, four travelers, known simply as the Daltons, rode into Gettysburg, PA. History has all but overlooked the Daltons' quest for fun activities. The Daltons found the options in Gettysburg nearly overwhelming. Segway tours of battlegrounds, biking, and horseback trails. And when Jeb, the youngest Dalton, saw Gettysburg's famed cyclorama, he was overheard to say, "Cool."
Make your own history. Visit DestinationGettysburg.com.
Blue the dog here for propane. Making the rounds with my owner, the propane man, has allowed me to see a lot. I may just be a simple dog. I didn't attend the elite boarding kennels. But I do know that propane fuels the independence of millions of Americans with clean, reliable energy and powers modern appliances from tankless water heaters to high-efficiency furnaces.
Brought to you by the Pennsylvania Propane Gas Association and your local propane service providers.
There's no denying we enjoy dining out, and we love to cut a rug on occasion as well. It's my pleasure to announce that you can put that dining and dancing together at Tanglewood every second Saturday of the month. A buffet dinner prepared by Chef George starts at 6:30, dancing from 7:30 till 10:30, just $16 per person. Come for just the dance and pay only $8. As always, it's BYOB. Break out your dancing shoes and work up an appetite for Tanglewood's dinner dance every second Saturday of the month. the month. Call 287-0021 for reservations.
Welcome back, folks. Interesting conversation there with Van Blatt. Hope you learned a little bit. I did. Coming up, we have we're going to be talking about the ARC of Butler County. It's a wonderful agency. We're going to get a little bit of an update about what they're doing, a little bit about their history. The ARC happens to be the next year Spotlight Nonprofit of the Month. At least that's the information I get from Carol Leshensky from next year. Am I right on that, Carol?
You are absolutely right on that, Dave. And, you know, we're excited. I think they're honestly our premier Spotlight Nonprofit Month. And no disrespect to the other nonprofits.
Of course,
but we have an exciting event that happens whenever we have the ARC be our Spotlight Nonprofit, and that's that we get to sell the candles that they make. And we actually, Alan brought in some to show you.
Oh, but, I see them here. Yeah,
yeah,
let's take a look at those. Yeah. Also with us is Alan Olson. Alan is the contract procurement specialist for the ARC of Butler County. Alan, good to see you again. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We will need to start out a little bit by making sure that all of our listeners know just what the ARC of Butler County is. So maybe you can give us a little overview in a nutshell here.
Yes. The ARC of Butler County is a nonprofit organization for the intellectually disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And we help the intellectually disabled in a series of ways. We have a residential setting where we have over 15 houses in the Butler County area, and we have the vocational side, which is our workshop at 100 North Washington Street. That's where I work at,
mm-hmm.
Where we have jobs there for folks, over 90-plus folks, do all types of work there, bulk mailings, packaging, assembly. We have janitorial, shredding, we have candles, and we have firewood. If you've been to Giant Eagle and you've seen the red bags of firewood, that's all firewood.
My engineer tells me, Alan, that I need to have you just pull your chair in a little bit more again. Well, that's perfect. That's grand. That's perfect. I want to make sure we can hear you fine. Fine and clear. The ARC of Butler County, I understand, celebrated a pretty significant anniversary this spring, right? All that long ago?
Back in April, on the 25th, we had our 60th anniversary.
60 years?
60 years.
Wow.
I've only been there 10.
Let me do the math. I used to be pretty good at this, but since we got into the new millennium, it throws me. It'll be 1957
then, right? That's
correct. That's 60 years? 1957, that's when you were incorporated?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
It was started by family members.
Really?
For the intellectually disabled. They got together and they started the chapter that is here in Butler.
There have been a couple of name changes. The most recent was 10, 15 years ago. The ARC of Butler County, and that name now ties in with, because there's the ARC of Pennsylvania and then the national name,
that is
too,
correct.
Right?
That is correct.
Yeah. And again, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Adults?
Adults.
Okay.
The average range would be, I would say, 21, and some of the older folks would probably be in their late 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm guessing, I don't have any knowledge here, but younger people, there would be some support and help for them through the public schools, through the public education system, right?
Well, what we're trying to do is there is help through the public schools, and as they transition out of the public schools, we are now trying to transition them into outside work, outside the workshop.
Absolutely.
Janitorial. We are growing by leaps and bounds on janitorial contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, we just picked up a new contract that will be starting the 1st of July, which would be the Butler State Troopers Barracks.
Wonderful.
So that's going to be a pretty big operation.
Now, you are a contract procurement specialist. I'm taking a wild guess here, Alan. If anybody's interested, they can probably contact you, right?
That is correct. If they have different types of jobs, they need it done, repetitive jobs, give me a call. You can reach me at 724-283-3300, extension 113.
the Arc of Butler County. And you said you're based at the Sheltered Workshop?
Yes, 100 North Washington.
Mm-hmm. Do they still call that the Sheltered Workshop, or is that term not used anymore?
Well, vocational.
Vocational?
Yes, vocational
okay.
workshop.
By the way, it used to be the post office a long, long time ago here in Butler.
That is correct.
And it still has the look of a post office from the 1940s.
Yes. We get a lot of folks that come in and they reminisce about when it was the post office, and they just marvel the architecture of the building.
It's a beautiful building.
Yes,
it is. I personally cannot remember when that was the post office. I have no idea when the new one was built. I know it was part of a HUD project because they demolished that whole block pretty much at one time when they built the new post office. Mm-hmm. I don't know when it was, 60s sometime. That's when that federal money was available. So, well, that would tie in because you were incorporated in the late 50s. So
that is correct.
The building would have become available. Yeah. So are you tied in with the state and federal funding at all? How do you operate? Where do you get your operating money, Alan?
Well, the majority, based on what I know, comes through the state.
Mm-hmm.
We get money from the state to train the folks that are at the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how most of our money comes through the state.
Mm-hmm. And of course, some of your work is self-supporting. You sell products, right?
That is also correct.
Yeah. Some of which you have displayed here on the table in front of me. This is intriguing. Are these all candle products?
Yes, they are. We have a 2-ounce melt that you would put in your melter. That's vanilla bean. It's one of the popular ones.
Can I open this and take a sniff?
Yes.
Is that okay? Let me do this. Oh, boy, that's tightly packaged. Why do you want to do that so the aroma doesn't escape? Huh?
Yes.
Ooh, that's pretty.
And then here's a 12-ounce tin, and that's one of our popular scents, which would be Love Spell.
Uh-huh. Boy, this would burn forever.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty too.
And it's 100% soy, so no soot. And they are cleaned and labeled by all of our folks.
Mm-hmm.
And they help in actually mixing the candle wax and the scent.
I don't want to skip over that 100% soy, because that's a big thing these days.
That is correct.
I switched to soy candles. I don't burn candles all the time, but it's nice at the holidays, right?
Yes.
Or on a chilly evening, light a candle. But I switched from regular candles, I don't know, about 10 years ago, when I discovered the soot that was inside the jar, you know, when it finishes, you say, where's this stuff going? And it's going onto your walls and everything else. And I said, what can I do? Somebody told me about soy candles. I'd never even heard of them. And there's no soot.
That is right. That is correct.
So you're 100% soy.
100% soy.
That's good.
And mm-hmm. last but not least, for the summer and outdoors, we do a strawberry lemon citronella candle.
I'm giving everything the sniff test here, folks. No, that's pleasant.
Yes.
Now, see, that's one of the problems that I have with some citronella candles. They are so powerful. They may keep mosquitoes away, but they keep me away, too.
That is true.
From the picnic table, they're just overpowering. What's this again? Strawberry?
Strawberry, lemon, citronella.
Mm. So mosquitoes hate it, but it's very pleasant for humans.
Oh,
nice.
Without a doubt.
And that comes in a
14-ounce
small
bucket.
Metal pail.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. What is that, aluminum?
Yes.
Nice. That won't rust either.
That is correct.
Yeah. I had a citronella candle once, left it out for a few weeks in the rain. It was glued to the top of the picnic table with rust and everything. So where are these products available, Al?
Right now, you can pick up these products at your local NextEar Bank.
There you go. You stop into your NextEar Bank branch, and you got them featured this month, huh?
We do, Dave. And actually, I got an email that Dave had delivered them on Monday to one of our branches, yes. And the supply that he had given them was already
gone.
Wow. And we needed more. So they're very popular. Our customers really look forward to – we try and do in the summer months because mm-hmm. it seems to make the most sense, and all of our customers mm-hmm. and employees, I might mm-hmm. add, really enjoy purchasing. And they're awesome. I use them all the time, and they last. best. You know, they're very adorable, and their scent is awesome. They compare with a lot of the major brands. So great job.
I'm going to leave the lid off this love spell here because this is so pleasant. Why do I read the label? Because I got to see what's in here. Tantalizing fragrance composed of a sweet bouquet of mandarin orange. Okay, I thought I smelled that. Tangerine, enhanced by hints of fresh peaches, strawberries, and raspberries with an undertone of white musk. No wonder it smells so good.
Yes, it's one of the popular ones.
Now, this is a candle, and it comes in a tin. I don't know how big is that.
It's a 12-ounce tin.
12-ounce. This is going to burn for a long time.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's a big candle. I'm going to leave the lid off. It's putting a nice aroma in the studio here. Now, this other one, and I'm sorry, I thought I was paying attention, Alan, but this doesn't, there's no wick. You don't burn this, it melts?
That is right.
Put it in some kind of a thing?
You put it in a melter, a little pot, and then it's a warmer.
Oh, yeah, okay, I've seen those.
It's like a little hot plate.
Yeah, a lot of people have those,
right.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about a wick or a flame.
So there's no actual fire.
That is correct.
Yeah. What was this again? Oh, vanilla.
That is vanilla bean.
Vanilla bean.
But I just want to make sure that the fragrance hasn't changed. That's nice. And then, of course, the strawberry, lemon, citronella.
That is correct.
How long have you been making these products? This is great stuff.
Well, we've probably been making these candles for well over 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Our executive director thought it would be a good idea to get into this type of business. We were always dependent upon outside individuals partnering with us to bring work into the workshop.
Contract work,
That is correct. Yeah, that is correct. Yeah. And he thought it would be best if we started to come up with lines of products that we could sell on our own. So the first one was the candles, and then we ventured into firewood. And so both of them had taken off. Pretty spectacular.
Let me ask about the firewood, because that's intriguing. Is that local? How do you get it?
It is local wood that we purchase, and then we package it there at the workshop in 100 North Washington, and then we sell it local areas. You can get it at the local Giant Eagle.
Looks like it's in string bags whenever it's packaged,
correct,
right?
That is correct.
For ease of handling.
Yes. Yeah. And we have it in Grove City, at Agway and Grove City. We have it at the Slippery Rock True Value.
Mm-hmm.
We have it at the Unimart in East Brady and Petrolia. If you're out in Cowansville, at Seibert's Gas and That.
I know where that is.
You can buy it there.
I know where that is. So you're not only getting your firewood, but you're helping the Ark.
That is correct.
Same time.
All of the individuals at the Ark that package it, all the proceeds go to them. So we just take that money and put it back into paying the workers' salaries and then just buying the products and services that we need to produce it.
You know, whoever came up with that idea, that's pretty forward-looking, because you can't get firewood very easily anymore these days. There are lots of places where it's restricted,
yes,
and because of certain state rules, you're not allowed to transport it.
That is correct.
From county to county a lot of times these days.
That is correct.
Now, those regulations vary from place to place in the state, but...
Yes.
You know, it has to do with the Emerald Ash Borer or something like that.
That is correct. Yeah. And so we try local wood, and we keep it local.
Exactly. Yes. That's why I was asking, yes. So that meets a need for people. Well, that's what you were talking about before. This is not just, I search for a term. It's not just busy work. There's a need here.
That is correct. The work that we do is something that someone needs. And it helps the vendors, and it helps employ our clients, and it gives them a sense of responsibility and self-worth.
Absolutely. I had that written down here on my note sheet to ask you about, because, as much as these are wonderful products and very useful and so on and so forth, I would have to think that one of the greatest value of the whole process is the self-worth, the dignity of the individual that this brings about.
That is correct. That is correct. They are very hardworking and dependable. Regardless if it's rain, sleet, or snow, they come to work, and they're ready to work. So.
And how many people do you have there all together?
We have, depending on the time of day, they can be anywhere between 90 up to 100 or so.
Do most of the individuals come every day, or is it like 2 days a week, or what's?
Well, on average, you get 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of individuals that are there 5 days a week.
All right.
Mainly those who are on our janitorial crews, which we take out Monday through Friday in the morning and at night.
So how's that handled? They're taken out as a crew?
Yes.
And then they complete their tasks, and then they're brought back?
That is correct. They come to the workshop. We have supervisors that are there. They go out to the work sites. The supervisors go with them. The supervisors work along with them. And then when the job is done, they come back to the workshop, and then their rides pick them up.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this, you say, has been one of the real growing areas?
It's been one of the real growing areas of our, of our business.
What are we talking about here, folks, on the It's Your Turn program today? Well, the ARC of Butler County, they've been around now, as of 2 months ago, for 60 years, as they celebrated their 60th anniversary of incorporation in April of this year. Did you have a, you know, like a cake and everything?
Yes, we did. We had a cake. We had what we call a employee appreciation banquet. We have that annually anyway, and we had it out at the atrium, and it was a great time.
Well, if there's ever a cause for a party, I think a 60th anniversary certainly fits the bill.
Yes.
You know, you want to have a little bit of a celebration. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the next year Spotlight nonprofit campaign. Carol Leshensky is here. She's a vice president with Next Tier. You've been doing this for a while now, haven't you?
We have. You know, Dave, I think you and I talked. We're in our third year now, and it's just, it's become a win-win situation. We get inquiries all the time for nonprofits, local nonprofits, to be a spotlight nonprofit. We do it at the end of every year so that we have a full year intact. So if there are any local nonprofits that have an interest in being one of our spotlight nonprofits, you can give me a call. I can be reached. I hate to give a number because it's not as easy as as Alan's was, but my cell 724-355-6728, and we'll be glad to include you. The only stipulation is you have to be a Next Tier customer. But it's been a win-win. Our customers look forward to it. Obviously, it benefits the nonprofits and our employees. And I think we forgot to mention how affordable the candles are.
Yes.
I don't think we mentioned that. They are only $6.
The melts, which are the 2 ounces, are $2.50.
Oh.
The 12-ounce is, I believe these are six.
Right.
And then the 14-ounce bucket is $7.
Oh, I'll see. So, Alan's correct. But they're still very affordable.
Absolutely.
You can't get a candle for that price, you know, anywhere as far as going to a retail store, and the quality's awesome.
Excellent. Are there benefits for the nonprofits doing banking with Next Tier?
We do have a lot of benefits. We offer traditional services as far as a checking, savings, but we have a lot of ancillary services to help them with many of the products and services beyond banking, such as collecting their payments, helping with donations, even helping them collect credit card payments, website development. We really found a few years back, as we mentioned, Dave, that the nonprofits were very underserved, and you know, their employees work hard. So if they can partner with a bank that can help them to fulfill their mission, you know, we're more than happy to. And don't forget, we have the pretzels too. Even though we're selling the candles, we still have the chocolate covered pretzels from Pfluger's Chocolate, and those are a big hit also.
Yeah, and that helps the agency a little bit as well.
Absolutely. We only pay for the cost of the pretzels, and then the proceeds go to the nonprofit.
We've kind of concentrated. Alan Olson is here. He's a contract procurement specialist for the ARC of Butler County. We've concentrated on the vocational services mainly, but there's a residential component to the ARC as well.
Yes, there
is. And is that, are there various levels of residential assistance? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, You're correct, Dave. There are different degrees of residential housing. We have, like I said, 15 houses in the Butler County area that house some of the clients. Then we also have a group of family homes. So you have individuals that will take in clients and they become a part of their families. We have individuals that have had clients in their homes for well over 20 or 30 years. And then we also have individuals that live independently. And so you will have a supervisor that will come in and check on them once a week, take them grocery shopping and things of that nature.
On the 15 or so homes that you have scattered throughout the county, are those community living facilities? Are there more than one person lives there?
Most of the time, yes, it will be more than one person. You can have, I believe, between 2 to 4 people that will live in a home, depending on the size of the home. And then there's 24-hour supervision in those homes.
And I know that you've only been with the ARC for 10 years, but I would be interested. Maybe I'll have to do a little digging on that. In the past 60 years, surely you couldn't have started out with all of these tremendous services from the get-go. It must have been building through the decades.
I believe it has been building through the decades. I believe it started probably with the workshop. And then it built into the needs of housing. We also have another branch called Career Opportunity Developments. So higher functioning individuals who need jobs in the community and need help in acquiring those jobs. We have job coaches that will go out and assist them in acquiring the job, in learning the skill set needed for the job, and then eventually, slowly but surely, back away so that, when that person is independent.
Let's talk a little bit. We would be remiss if we didn't, while we have a chance to chat with you, talk about the what I think is just a marvelous change in attitude on the part of society toward individuals who have an intellectual or developmental disability. I mean, it's been a sea change, really, and it's just in the past few decades.
Oh, I agree with you, Dave. I believe in the 70s, you normally would have had individuals with intellectual disabilities sent to institutions. So, and then when that went away, they became a part of the community, and then it was our jobs and agencies like ours to help integrate them into the community. And so I think we've done a pretty good job.
Have you found on the part of society, the general public, more acceptance in recent years? Is there a greater understanding? I've noticed it. I don't know. Maybe it's the circle that I travel in.
Yes, I do. I do. Based on the contracts and the interactions that I have with folks in the community and their willingness to partner with us to do all types of jobs and the acceptance of our products, the candles, the firewood, even the janitorial jobs that we do.
I think it needs to even go more than just acceptance. I think everybody has to understand that just because a person has an intellectual or a developmental disability, they still have a right to work.
Yes.
They still have a right to a job.
Yes.
They still have a right to live.
I agree.
You know?
And we are...
it's not something that the rest of society grants them out of their benevolence.
That is correct.
There's a right to that, right?
That is correct. And we are experiencing a more opening and mindset and a willingness to take the opportunity and the risk to bring to hire these folks and to bring them in.
Does the ARC of Pennsylvania, maybe even locally too, the ARC of Butler County, do you advocate for that, for these rights of these individuals?
Without a doubt. That's not something that I necessarily have any background in. But
I know that's not your job.
Right. But we, yes, we
part
do
of,
have
part of the mission of the ARC,
that is
right?
Correct. We do have individuals on staff that is their job.
Well, good. I'm happy about that. And I love these products. Again, folks, if you're interested in these, you can check out all of the candles are available at any next year bank branch through the end of June, which is only a week into June. So they're available for purchase.
Or you can come into our lobby at 100 North Washington Street or our headquarters lobby at 112 Hollywood Drive, Suite 202, and we have them on display there.
The vocational workshop is, if you're not sure where it is, the old post office, going back a decade, it's one block off Main Street. It's right in the center of Butler.
That is correct.
Washington and Jefferson, right?
Yes.
Corner of Washington and Jefferson. And there's a lobby in the front?
There's a lobby in the front. And we invite individuals to come in and take a tour. Most people are blown away when they find out exactly the jobs and opportunities that we have for the clients.
You know, I'm going to have to go down and take a. I haven't been in that building in a long time. I'm going to have to go down and take a fresh look myself.
We'd be happy to have you.
Dave, I might mention, too, that if you want to stop in, obviously, to purchase a candle or a chocolate-covered pretzel, but we will also accept donations for our Spotlight Nonprofit of the Month. So that's an option, too, if you're really interested and you want to embrace an organization and help out financially, you can stop at any one of our branches.
That's terrific. Well, thank you. Carol Oshensky's here, Vice President for Next Tier and the Next Tier Spotlight Nonprofit of the Month, the ARC of Butler County. And we're most happy to get an update on the agency from Alan Olson. Good to see you again, Alan.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
And you too, Carol.
Thanks, Dave.
More to come on It's Your Turn. Ginger Fenton, Penn State Dairy Extension Educator, is going to be joining us on the next segment of the program. In fact, we'll be talking to Ginger here in just a moment or so, right after these words. Be right back.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Whether you're a backyard car fixer-upper or an auto repair shop, Milich Auto Wrecking is still the place to go for new and used auto and truck parts. They have been for over 40 years. And compared to factory prices, you'll save big bucks. Milich Auto Wrecking is neatly organized and will tell you immediately if they have the part or not. Open Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5. It's Milich Auto Wrecking, Route 38, the Oneida Valley Road. Look for the big black and red sign. Stop by or call 287-1001. And yes, old Uncle Fred still goes to Milich.
Welcome back, good friends. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. And as I told you at the beginning of our program earlier this afternoon, on the next segment, we're going to be talking with Ginger Fenton. Ginger is Dairy Extension Educator for Penn State Extension, and she joins us by telephone today. Ginger, how you doing? Nice to talk to you again.
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Under the model that Extension now operates, and it has now for, I guess, about the past 5 years or so, it's a nice model because we have Extension educators who specialize in certain areas. Every county could not possibly afford to have an educator in every area. So the trained educators are now shared among several counties, usually geographically close together. You work out of the Mercer County Penn State Extension Office, right, Ginger?
That's correct, yes.
But you cover Butler County as well.
I do. I cover about 10 counties in the northwestern corner of Pennsylvania.
Oh, you've got a pretty big geographical footprint to cover there.
Yes. Keeps me busy.
So what are the general responsibilities of a dairy extension educator? What do you do?
That's a good question. We respond to questions a lot of times. We're here to provide technical expertise to dairy producers, and I also get calls from consumers that may have questions that are related to dairy. We have divided, you mentioned the new Penn State model, and we've kind of divided our assignments so that the educators have different areas of expertise. And my specialty and interest, one of them is in milk quality and food safety. So I answer questions and teach workshops and write newspaper columns and popular press articles related to the topics of milk quality and safety.
Mm-hmm. Has that been your area of specialization for some time, Ginger?
Yes. It's shifted a little bit. This is actually the second time I worked for Penn State Extension, and I just used to teach food safety when I worked for Extension before.
So you've expanded a little bit now.
Yes, I tell people now instead of working with the consumers and the retailers, I also work with the processors and work a lot more with what we call pre-harvest food safety, so food safety practices on the farm.
I was speculating earlier on the program today, telling the listeners that you were going to be visiting with us this half hour, and I was speculating that I think dairy production is still a fairly sizable part of the business of agriculture here in western Pennsylvania. I know in Butler County in particular, tourism has taken over as the number one industry. But agriculture is still high up there. It's number two. It was number one for a long, long time. And I don't know the percentage, the breakdown, but I know that the dairy is still a part of that. Is it still significant in western Pennsylvania, the area that you cover? We still have a lot of dairy farms?
It has declined some. In general, Pennsylvania is still a strong dairy state. Pennsylvania is ranked sixth in the country.
Oh.
For the amount of milk that is produced, which is a little bit interesting. We're kind of unique because Pennsylvania has many smaller farms. And so we are actually number two in the United States for the number of farms, number of dairy farms, second only to Wisconsin.
I would never have guessed that. I'm happy to hear it, but I would have guessed Wisconsin because, I mean, you know, that's where... You know, the Green Bay fans, they call themselves the Cheeseheads. We know that's a big dairy state. But I didn't know that Pennsylvania was that high. Have you seen more, and I realize I'm generalizing here, and it's going to vary from county to county, but I've heard some reports of some dairy farms that are, you know, they're becoming larger because some smaller ones have sold out and then have kind of glommed onto some neighboring farms and so on and so forth. Are you seeing that at all?
Yes, I'd say that's a trend in the industry. The milk prices have not been good for several years now, and that makes it tough. Feed prices have stayed lower, which is some relief to the farmers, but some people have chosen not to stay in the business because of the low prices. But interestingly, in looking at numbers of cows, we are still holding steady. So I think what you suggested, that maybe they're just being sold to some other farms that are growing a little bit, I think that we are seeing some of that.
Milk prices in Pennsylvania are regulated, are they not?
They are, and that's a very complex issue.
I wouldn't ask you to try to describe it. I know it's extremely complex, but I know that they're state regulated, and I've never quite understood why, but I mean, you know, we're a free market economy, aren't we, right? But at any rate, they are. The prices are regulated.
Yes, there's actually a board in Pennsylvania, and I just, now that you mentioned it, got a fact sheet. I printed it earlier today. It's really lengthy, but it explains how milk is marketed in Pennsylvania and explains the Milk Marketing Board.
Milk Marketing Board, I remember that term now as soon as you said it, and so because of that, it can be a little difficult on farmers. I know there was a time, it's within the past 5 years, I don't remember exactly when it was, but I talked to a couple of dairy farmers, said they were losing money being in the dairy business. You know, the milk prices were so low at that time. They were actually losing money, you know.
There's a study that some of my coworkers have done at Penn State. They call it Crops to Cow. And I think it's really interesting because they're trying to tie some of the management practices that we see on farms together with cash flow records. And one of the things, all the farms enrolled in that farm, it's voluntary. There's 24 farms in the study, but just like you mentioned, there's a huge range with what they're finding, even on those 24 farms in the study, from what they call their break-even cost, so what they're getting for their milk versus what it costs to produce that milk. There's more than a $5 range.
Wow.
So it just depends on if farmers own their own equipment, what their bills are, what the price is that they're getting for their milk, although there might not be quite as much flexibility there. If they're paying rent, I mean, there's many paying for labor, many factors that go into that. So, but some, you're right, some people are just breaking even, if that, some years. And then there are still some farms that, may have a different production model and may be doing fine.
We're talking, listeners, with Ginger Fenton. She's with Penn State Extension. Her territory that she covers includes Butler County, and she is a dairy extension educator. Hey, there's a big conference, a big meeting, a national association of some sort meeting in Pittsburgh later this month. What's that all about, Ginger?
Yes, I'm actually really excited to know that Pittsburgh is the host of the American Dairy Science Association. It's also referred to as ADSA,
mm-hmm.
is going to be meeting in Pittsburgh here at the end of June. And there'll be, it's an international conference, actually.
Oh, wow.
Experts in dairy production and from both on the farm aspects and the dairy food production will all be meeting at the convention center in Pittsburgh for this conference. So it's nice that it's so close. I'm planning to spend some time there and take advantage of the access to the experts and to hear some of the talks that will be presented. Actually, and we have an opportunity as part of that conference for dairy producers to attend, which is a little bit unusual. Sometimes these meetings are geared more towards the academic and the scientific folks, but
mm-hmm.
on Sunday, the 25th of June, the day before the conference officially kicks off, there is a program called The Impact of Raw Milk Quality on Dairy Products. And there are speakers coming from Oregon and Iowa, a couple of us from Penn State, and we'll be talking about different aspects related to milk production on the farm, such as water quality, microbial quality, feed, and how it affects dairy products. I'll be giving a talk on milking practices
mm-hmm.
and things that farmers can do to make the best quality and safest product. But I think it's a unique opportunity, and I'm glad to be able to be part of it.
So you'll be presenting actually as part of that thing, huh? Wow.
Yes. Yeah. And then. Mm-hmm.
Ginger Fenton is visiting with us, a dairy extension educator. I've always considered myself lucky. I've loved milk from the time that I was a little kid. And I always kind of chuckle a little bit when I hear about parents who, always urging their kids to drink milk, for healthy teeth and bones and so on. I could not get enough milk when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a penance for me to drink milk. I enjoyed it. I still do. Love dairy products, so I've never had
Great.
To worry about that.
We like to hear that.
Well,
that's what we like.
Every once in a while, I like to put a little Hershey's in mine. I don't think that hurts, does it?
Mm-hmm. No, a little bit. Moderation.
Everything in moderation, huh?
One
thing that I know has changed, certainly in the past generation or so, and that's the number of actual dairy production operations in western Pennsylvania. There used to be a lot more small dairy production facilities. I think most dairy farmers now have their milk picked up, right, and taken to larger processing centers, larger dairies?
Yes, that's what the majority do. And you're right, I think we just had a conversation recently, our dairy team statewide of all the educators, and we were talking about some of the, the number of processors and how those locations have changed over the years. But one trend that we're seeing more of, I get this call pretty frequently from producers. They're interested in what we call value-added dairy.
Mm.
And
what's
so that would be...
What's that mean, Ginger?
Sure. value-added, it's kind of like the, just like the name sounds, but it means that producers are somehow doing something to their product to set it apart from the others in the market, which hopefully gives them a little bit better price, or maybe gives them access to a different market.
Would they be actually physically changing their milk or their other product?
They may be. Value-added encompasses several things. They may physically create a new product with it. A good examples of that would be, and you already mentioned it with chocolate milk.
Mm-hmm.
Even just chocolate milk is considered a value-added product. Any other type of flavored milk, which I think the processors are getting more and more creative. You know, as you see some very unique flavors on the market now, with like birthday cake flavored milk or chocolate peanut butter flavored milk.
I haven't seen that yet.
There's quite a few out there, and I think they're seasonal too. Another example would be, and maybe easier to visualize, of physical change would be producing cheese. Yogurt's popular, and that market seems to be holding pretty strong.
I never heard of yogurt butter. Even when I was a kid, or even a teenager. I didn't know what yogurt was. I never heard of it. Now you see it in every supermarket has yogurt.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Just think about even the space, even in the past few years, that supermarkets devote now to yogurt.
Yeah.
Used to be one small section, and I think that market share has grown greatly, especially with Greek yogurt, and there's just so many options now.
Mm-hmm. What about
that would be one?
What about in the actual production process? Can they come up with the value-added dairy by making some changes there?
Yes. Yeah, that would be another avenue. You'll see, and I encourage people to read labels in the dairy section. That's where you can pick up some of these things. But, for example, grass-fed milk. So the cows are required to be on pasture or to have their diet comprised primarily of grass for a certain percentage of the time to have that grass-fed label. Organic is another one you're probably familiar with and have seen. Some people even market the milk by the breed of cattle. An example, we have a large event here in Mercer County every year. The Guernsey breeders have an ice cream supper, they call it. And the milk that they sell at that ice cream dinner, or the ice cream they sell, is from milk from Guernsey cows.
I'm smiling a little bit, Ginger, because the town where I spent my childhood years, very small town, it was Parker's along the Allegheny River, but we had there was a dairy there. I mean, it's hard to believe as small as that town is, and way back when they marketed that they only had Guernsey cows, you know, and it was called the Golden Guernsey Milk. Wow.
Okay. I think we may see more of that, not with Guernsey or with other breeds. You know, people, we're seeing a lot of different trends with the food, and people kind of look for those specific breeds or tastes.
Let's talk about some other trends in value-added products. You mentioned the cheese earlier. Boy, now there's an area where the amount of space devoted to cheese and varieties of cheese in the supermarket aisle has really increased over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. Cheese is one of the bright spots in the dairy industry right now. Fluid milk consumption is down. People just aren't drinking as much milk. But cheese consumption is continuing to increase in the United States, and I think it is in some of our other markets as well. If you look, you mentioned the aisles in the supermarket, the artisanal cheeses. You know, different varieties, different flavors that we never would have thought of have been created, and there are all kinds of new labels out there, and there's definitely a major interest in these specialty cheeses.
I love cheese. And then, of course, there's our old friend butter. And isn't that an interesting story? I'm a baby boomer, Ginger. When I was a kid, that was butter. That's what everybody had. And then we went to, you know, we went to the margarine. We went to, obviously, I'm not going to mention the brand names, but that became the popular thing. And now we find out fairly recently, actually, within the past decade or so, that maybe that was all wrong. Maybe butter was the most healthy thing after all. So butter is—it's making a comeback, isn't it?
It is. It is, and we're even seeing certain restaurant chains are promoting that they're using butter again.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a positive step for the dairy industry.
Well, it certainly tastes better, and if it turns out to be healthier for us, all the better, huh?
Yes.
And all the better for the dairy industry as well. We need to take a quick break here. We have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Ginger. Ginger Fenton is a Penn State Extension dairy educator with Penn State Extension visiting with us by telephone today. The midday lottery numbers are here. We have a message or two to pass on. Stick with us. We'll be back to talk more with Ginger in just a couple of minutes. Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 8787. The pick 3, 989, 989. The pick 4, 2409. The pick 5, 83454. The wild ball for each of those is 3. The treasure hunt, 8, 10, 15, 20, and 26. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $120,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
One of our sponsors on the program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Boy, what a wonderful job these folks do at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul in so many ways to help the needy and the less fortunate. They have their St. Vincent de Paul Society thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart. They've got their client aid program. And they've got their food bank, and their food bank is much used. In fact, they recently, just a year or so ago, had to expand their warehouse and to add some more refrigeration facilities. Here's what I'd like to ask you to do, to think about as the gardens start to come on now, and it won't be too much longer. Think about donating a little bit of the produce from your garden. Maybe you pick one tomato plant or a couple of pepper plants. You say, I'll tell you what. Anything comes off those two plants, I'm going to donate to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. They have a wonderful collection program Saturdays. You can just take your produce to St. Michael's School Hall behind St. Michael's Church on the south side. We'll tell you when that program kicks off. Obviously, a lot of folks just getting gardens in within the past week or two. But we'll let you know. And it's very convenient. And believe me, that fresh produce from your garden, homegrown, is in the food bank the following Monday morning. It's a wonderful program, and what a treat for people and families who rely on the food bank, because, you know, most of this stuff is non-perishable, you know. Fresh produce, oh, wonderful, wonderful. So think about it, if you can see your way clear. Society of St. Vincent de Paul, we stand the tallest when we stoop to help others. We're chatting by telephone with our guest here on the It's Your Turn program right now. She is Ginger Fenton. Ginger is a dairy educator, dairy extension educator with Penn State Extension. And we're talking about, I guess we were talking about a big International Dairy Science Association meeting that's going to be coming to Pittsburgh at the end of this month. There are some interesting facts that I've learned, Ginger, from some of the background information that you supplied me with. For example, I had no idea how much milk it takes to make a pound of cheese.
Yes, 10 pounds.
10 pounds of milk to make a pound of cheese. And I also have to confess to you that I have no idea how much 10 pounds of milk is. I wonder why do they sell milk by weight anyway? When you go to the supermarket, you buy by the quart or the half gallon or the gallon. But dairy farmers sell it by the pound, don't they?
They do. They sell it by what they call the hundred weight. And yes, it's not in gallons, and I never really thought about it. I'm not exactly sure why the difference.
Well, they've sure made it confusing, haven't they? They've got this complex milk marketing board thing, and then they sell it by weight, and why couldn't they just make it easy? I don't know.
I don't know.
What else is happening in the world of dairy here locally in western Pennsylvania?
One of the things I'd like to mention that's coming up, it kind of ties into our value-added and that we've been talking about, and consumers being more in touch with where their food comes from. We've seen such a disconnect. So many people are not familiar with farms. Most weren't raised on a farm. And so there are groups that are taking steps to help educate consumers. One of those events that we have coming up in Mercer County, and it's open to the public, it's a free event, but I'd like to mention it's on a dairy farm. We're calling it the Mercer County Agricultural Brunch on the Farm. And the idea is that it allows consumers to come visit a farm, to see animal welfare firsthand, to understand a little bit more about the process by which the cattle are raised and how we get milk from dairy cows.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of it is education. It will be held on Saturday, September 23rd. It begins at 9 in the morning, and it's at Cannon Dairy Farm, which is in West Middlesex in Mercer County.
Oh, that's easy to get to from here. That's right off I-80, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. It is. We have a page on Facebook. I think it's Mercer County Ag Brunch on the Farm. I believe if you search, you could find it on Facebook and follow if that someone would like more details. We also have a website, MercerCountyAgDevelopment.com, and there will be details posted there. One of the things that is unique about our host farm, they are the first farm in Mercer County that I'm aware of to use what we call automated milking systems, or robots, to milk their cows.
Get out. They got robots milking cows there. Wow.
They do. probably not quite what you're picturing, but the cows can enter the robot. It's like a stall, and it uses lasers basically to line up. There are little brushes that come, and they automatically prepare the udder, and they place the milking machine on the cow, and the cows are milked without a human actually touching them.
Wow. Well, you know, we've seen, and you see this in car commercials for years now, about the way they use robots to, you know, do spot welding when they're assembling a car. So I guess the technology is there. But don't you have to, aren't there some hygiene practices in dairy production? Listen to me. I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I mean, don't you have to, like, wash the udders and the teats before you milk a cow? Can a robot do that?
The robot does that, but you're right. You're correct. That is an important part of the process. That's one of those food safety processes that also helps with the cows. We call it letting their milk down better or producing, giving more milk.
Yeah.
But the robot has. Well, it depends on the name brand. Some of them have brushes, or they have. Maybe think of it like a kind of a little automatic car wash.
Okay.
In there, and the robot will do the udder preparation.
Wow.
It'll get the cow all ready to be milked, and then it'll switch over and milk her. And
now I have seen,
and off she goes.
For many years, actually, I've seen the, probably using the wrong terminology, but, you know, like automatic milking machines, but they had to be placed on the udder by humans, you know. It was a part human process. I mean, as opposed to the old, you know, milking stool, three-legged stool, like we saw in the nursery rhymes. Wow.
Yep. You're correct.
Robot milking operation.
Yes. Kinda but like all those systems are in place. I mean, I have visited farms where they milk by hand still, too.
Really?
But then there's a wide range in technology out there. And the robots are not really that new. They're newer to this area, but we're seeing more of them. It's just it's a different type of management and a different type of labor. And the farmer spends more time doing other things and becomes more of a data manager than having their hands on the cows all the time.
Now, that's an interesting educational event coming up in early autumn, and you can even get breakfast on the farm if you partake in that. Well, gosh, Ginger, I appreciate talking to you today. We've covered a whole lot of ground here. But it was very informative, and that's what we like to do on this program when we talk with the Penn State Extension educators. After all, you're sharing your knowledge with our listeners, and we appreciate the time.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to promote dairy, and thank you. It's been enjoyable.
And right now, I'm going to go have a big glass of chocolate milk.
Great. Good.
Thanks, Ginger. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ginger Fenton from Penn State Extension. I do like milk. I'm not kidding. I really do. Hey, coming up, goodness, David, look at the time. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pat Collins is going to be here tomorrow. Pat's the director of the Butler County Historical Society. They're bringing in a big World War II traveling exhibit, I think this month. I don't know. We'll get all the details from Pat. I'm really, really interested in seeing that, finding out about it. That's tomorrow. And also tomorrow, Dr. Nick Neupower, president of Butler County Community College.